Turn to Proverbs 6 and verse 8. We're still learning from the ant here. And verse 8, I'll just read verses 6 through 8, I suppose. Proverbs 6, 6. Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer, and gathereth her food in the harvest. So we want to look at that verse 8, that the ant provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. And she does so, as we see there in verse 7, without any guide, overseer, or ruler. She provides for her necessities. This is interesting. The definition of provide here is it is to prepare, get ready, or arrange something beforehand. It says now rare. But it actually uses the Coverdale Bible of 1535, and it uses this verse, in the summer she provideth her meat and gathereth her food in the harvest. So this would actually be the definition to be used here, and it makes a lot of sense in this context, that to provide in this case is to prepare, get ready, or arrange something beforehand. Because if you think about it, especially if you lived on a farm, the summer would be spent providing for the food in the sense of preparing and getting ready to harvest, right? So it actually does make sense. And then also provide means to equip or fit out a person, etc., with what is necessary for a certain purpose, to furnish or supply with something implied. And that's typically how we think of provide, to furnish or supply with something that is necessary whenever we're providing food or clothing or housing or whatever it might be. And the definition even goes on to say there in the quote from 1628, to provide or furnish with a lodging. So this is serious business for us Christians, to provide for ourselves and our families, as it says in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. 1 Timothy 5, 8. This is just as important of a tenet of the faith as really anything else is, as you'll see here. 1 Timothy 5, 8 says, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. So if you had a person that just refused to work and, you know, their family was just starving or something, like that would be an excludable offense, right? I mean, we're worse than an infidel if you just refuse to work and will not provide for those in your care. Now, in this country, this is becoming more and more prevalent. I found a statistic here that at least half of the people in this country are not providing for themselves and their families, but are relying on the government to do it, at least to one extent or the other. And this is actually from an article in 2012, so it's quite old, really, and they're citing 2011, so we're really talking about 10 years ago here. It says, this is from the Washington Post, who receives government benefits in 6 charts. It says, in 2011, about 49% of the population lived in a household where at least one member received a direct benefit from the federal government. A big chunk of these households are retirees, and about 27% households, and that's not a typo I checked, should be 27% of households, benefited from a means-tested poverty. So you're talking 50% at least of people that are receiving a benefit of some kind from the government today. And, you know, that's concerning, and that was 10 years ago, and I imagine that it hasn't gotten any better in the last 10 years. So from this verse, we see that the ant provides her own meat. And meat is food in general, anything used as nourishment for men or animals, usually solid food in contradistinction to drink. So in other words, the ant provides for her food. And the ant works to eat, right? And so must we. And as we saw, I think it was in the last study, we looked at 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10, that if a man would not work, neither shall he eat. 2 Thessalonians 3:10 says, for even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. So if you have a person that could work but just refuses to or something, then he's going to be, he shouldn't eat. And, you know, when you have, there's a lot of people, like in this town, that are on welfare. I'm just guessing. I didn't look up the numbers. I don't know if I could have even found it. But if you drive around this town, you can just tell that there's a lot of people in this town that are on welfare. And I just from driving the bus, I wasn't on a town route, but whenever I would drive a route in town, and You'd be picking up a little preschooler, and both mom and dad or whoever they were are there dropping her off, and it's like, yeah, you can both drop her off because you ain't working, right? And these are young people.
I mean, I think Excelsior's worse than some of the surrounding communities by far. It's got a reputation for it. Yeah. It seems to attract them for some reason.
Yeah, I could tell that just from living here a short time and just looking around.
We'll go for a drive sometime. I'll show you some neighborhoods that will blow your mind in this town.
Yeah. I don't know why that is, but northeast. Northeast. Oh, okay. Oh, like up in like Excelsior Village?
No, there's a whole bunch of HUD east.
Oh, east, other.
There's a whole bunch of HUD residences up there. When I drove a little bus up there sometimes, that's nasty up there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was a long time ago, but it has not gotten better.
No, and I was hearing this when I was young. Somebody said, I don't know where it came from, but somebody told me that there was somebody in New Jersey that knew to go to Excelsior Springs. I don't know.
Oh, to get on welfare?
I remember the story. Yeah, I don't know. And that was so many years ago.
Wow.
It has to do with the availability of people that know how to get you help.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's the Good Samaritan Center and Need and some places like that.
Yeah, it's like, sadly, the places that are set up to help the poor end up creating a lot more of them. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. You know, it says in Proverbs 19:15 that an idle man should suffer hunger. Proverbs 19:15. It says, slothfulness casteth into a deep sleep, and an idle soul shall suffer hunger. So the ant provideth her food, her meat in the summer, and gathereth her food in the harvest. So having provided her food in the summer, now the ant gathers it. And that really makes sense when you look at that definition of provide, where it means to prepare and get ready. Right? So she prepares and gets it ready in the summer and then gathers it in the harvest. To gather is to bring things together, to collect from different quarters into one mass or place, to acquire by such means to amass, also to gather together. This is exactly what farmers would do. In those days, and in these days, for that matter, you provide your food, provide for your, you get ready in the summer, in other words, and then you go and you gather up all that you provided in the summer, all the seeds that you planted and watered and nourished, then you gather them all together and bring them into the barn. Harvest is the third of the four seasons of the year, the autumn. It is the season for reaping and gathering in the ripened grain. So provision for food is made in the summer and gathering is done in the harvest. And so the sluggard can learn from the ant about when it is crucial to work during the year. So as with a lot of the Bible, there is like a direct application, and then there's a more broad application that we can do. So the first one would be a direct application, like when should a person work during the calendar year? And we can learn this from the ant. So it's necessary to work when the weather's nice, before cold weather sets in, when it's hard or impossible to work, obviously. Work must be done in the early spring of the year if a bountiful crop is to be reaped in the harvest. So you got to get working early in the year. And if you don't do that, like I talked about last time, then you'll end up not doing so well in the end of the year whenever the harvest comes. Proverbs 20 and verse 4. It says, a sluggard will not plow by reason of the cold, therefore shall he beg and harvest and have nothing. So it's necessary to start early in the spring, and then work through the year. And this is especially important for a farmer, obviously, or for other people in seasonal occupations, which I'll talk about here in just a second. So the work must continue through the summer months in preparation for the harvest. And this is what the ants do. They're wise, and they prepare their meat in the summer. Proverbs 30 and verse 25. It says, the ants are a people not strong, yet they prepare their meat in the summer. They get it ready. To prepare means to put beforehand into a suitable condition for some action, to set in order previously for some purpose, to get ready, make ready, put in readiness, to fit out or equip. So summer is the time for preparing and getting ready, in other words, getting ready to reap the harvest. And then we have autumn, or the harvest. This is the most important time of year to labor, because it is then that the fruits of a man's work will be reaped, which is the result of all the hard work that he put in starting in the spring. So the ant prepares and gets her food ready in the summer in expectation of the harvest and the coming winter. And in the harvest, the food is gathered and brought together to be kept safe until it's needed in the winter. So not many of us are farmers, and we're not actually gathering our food. I mean, if you have a garden, you are. So, I mean, in a sense, we do that. We work hard, and you know, you get planting early when you need to in the spring. Then you weed and water during the summer. You're preparing it, and then you harvest it in the fall. And then if you're not going to waste it, a lot of work has to be done with canning or drying or whatever you have to do to put it up. And, you know, we do that. I think probably most of us, most people, I think, do it more for fun than anything else, and maybe for some fresh food, but they're not really relying on it to actually live or survive. But I do think it's a good idea in our day and age to have a storage of food and supplies and money laid up in your house in case of an emergency or a layoff or a natural disaster, anything like that. And I've told you this for a long time, and I think most of you have done it, which is great. Having food laid up in the house is a good idea. And money too. You know, I think 3 to 6 months of living expenses having laid up is a good idea, just in case. You never know what could happen. And if you doubt that, just think back to 2020. You never know what can happen, right? There can be very unexpected things that happen. That's one thing I've certainly learned from this year. So wise men will gather in the summer and harvest, but fools will sleep in the harvest and cause shame to themselves and others. Proverbs 10 and verse 5. Proverbs 10 and verse 5. It says, he that gathereth in summer is a wise son, but he that sleepeth in harvest is a son that causeth shame. You can imagine if you planted a garden, did all that work in the summertime, and then it comes time to start picking all of your vegetables, and you're just like, I'm just tired. I'm gonna sleep. That would be a shameful thing, obviously. So once winter sets in, it's too late to work, and then one must live on whatever you produced and saved throughout the year. And so this exhortation here is especially important for farmers, which most of us are not, but also for seasonal occupations such as paving crews, concrete crews, excavation crews. You think about JP, like if he was not being like the ant and working hard as soon as the weather breaks in the spring and working hard all year right up until the absolute last day that he can possibly work, putting up all that money to get through the winter and to get his employees, how many of them are on salary through the winter, if he wasn't doing that, he'd be out of business like the first year, right? He'd be toast. So I'm sure if he probably never has read Proverbs 6, I suppose, but he figured it out without reading it, because it is common sense, obviously. But then we can also learn a more broad application of this, and that is when it is important to work in the course of one's life. So if we look at the seasons representing time periods of life, we can also learn some things. So the spring is the time of life. So the springtime of life is when a person is just entering his working years. He's just getting started. And at this time in life, it would be the time to determine what your talents and aptitudes are, the skills that God's given you, and then begin to get an education or learn some kind of a trade to develop those abilities. So that would be the part, you know, when you're a teenager, you're in your 20s, you're just starting out, the spring of life. And if you get off to a stunted start in the spring of life, then you're going to have a harder time whenever it comes, you know, to the harvest, because you just haven't had as many years working and getting built up in skills, as other people have. So it's good to get a good start. And then the summertime of life is when a man starts into his career and he's in growth mode. And during this time, he becomes more knowledgeable and productive and continues to increase his income. And this is the time to start saving money and laying up wealth, because now you're really starting to be able to make some money, right? You're not in your prime yet, but you are. Your education's over, your training's over, and now it's work time. And then you have the autumn or the harvest. And in the harvest time of life, a man is at his peak career. He's got a lot of knowledge, a lot of experience, and his productive capacity is at its max. He's still able to work and use his talents that he's spent a lifetime acquiring. And all of the planting and watering and weeding that he has spent years doing is now paying off with a bountiful harvest at this time of life. He's making the most money of his life, and his expenses should be at the lowest point in his life, having all of his debt paid off and having an empty nest where all the kids are grown and out of the house. And now is the time where you can really reap the reward of a lifetime of labor and work and save as much money as possible while you still can work. It's like Jesus taught in John 9 and verse 4 that we have to work while it is day because the night cometh when no man can work. John 9 and verse 4. I must work the works of him, Jesus said. I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. And I think about this verse in my own ministry, and I really want to work while it's day. Right now, it is day. And hopefully for me, it's going to be daylight for a long time. But at my age, it's daylight. I mean, I've got lots of energy and youth, and I really want to do as much as I possibly can, that because someday I won't be able to if I live long enough. And then you have the winter time in life. And the winter time of life is when a man is now beyond his working years. He's old, he's physically incapable of working, and at this point he should have a large store of wealth laid up so that he can live off of it for the rest of his life so that he doesn't have to be a burden on somebody else. So that's the spring, summer, harvest, and winter of life. And we can learn from the ant about the importance of providing that in the summer and then reaping in the harvest and then getting us through the winter of life. And Americans desperately need to hear this message and learn from the wise ant, because the vast majority of Americans have little to nothing saved from retirement. And I'm going to read you here an article that I just saw the other day. It was just like perfect timing. I was just having to be looking through Zero Hedge, and I saw this article. Or I saw an article that linked to this article, because this one's a couple of years old. But this was on Zero Hedge. It's called Retirement Crisis. The typical working American has nothing saved for retirement. So the article says, a startling new report issued by the nonprofit National Institute on Retirement Security found that despite the, quote, recovery, unquote, of the last decade, leading to all-time highs in the stock market, the savings levels of Americans who seek to retire are, quote, deeply inadequate, unquote. In fact, the median retirement account balance among working individuals was found to be $0. Now you think, how can the median retirement savings of Americans be zero? You think that's impossible. How can the average be zero? You have to understand the difference between mean and median. Does anybody know what the difference between mean and median is?
Median's in the middle and mean is average. Like, take it all and divide it by however many.
Yes, that's exactly right. So for example, let's say you have 100 people and 25 of them have $100,000 in their retirement account and the other 75 have nothing in their retirement account. The mean would be $25,000. If you add all that up and divide it by 100, you'd get $25,000. Now, if I gave you that stat, I mean, that's pitiful, $25,000 for retirement. But if I gave you that stat anyway, you could say, well, you know, $25,000, at least they have something. But if you look at the median, 25 people have $100,000 in the bank in retirement, 75 have nothing, the median is zero. Because if you spread them all out and you start on the right side with all the zeros, and then you go up, and so it's going from smallest to greatest, you're going to have 75 zeros, 2,500,000. The median is at 50, and 50 is what? Zero, right? The first 75 are nothing, right? So that's why the median retirement account balance is zero in this country.
About like 401ks here.
401ks.
Like just savings accounts.
No, 401ks, IRAs, retirement accounts specifically. It says the report found that more than 100 million Americans that are of working age don't have any retirement account assets in an employer-sponsored 401k type plan, individual account, or pension at all. 100 million Americans. Well, we know just from the if the mean is zero, that means that at least half have nothing, right? Because you'd have to have zero up to the 50%, you know, up to the middle. So we know at least half, and 100 million Americans that are of working age. There's only 330 million Americans in this country. And I don't know how many are of working age, but, you know, this has got to be well over half, or at least half. But you have nothing, no retirement set up whatsoever. To make matters worse, 4 out of 5 working Americans were also found to have less than 1 year's income in their retirement accounts. So of those who do have a retirement account, 80% of working Americans have less than a year's income. How are you going to retire if you only have enough money to live for a year? I mean, that's crazy. Even those who are trying to save for retirement are failing to do so effectively, according to the study. It's stated that 77% of Americans come up short of even the most conservative retirement savings targets for their age, based on estimates that have them working until age 67. So 77 come up short, and that makes sense because most of them have zero, and zero is definitely coming up short, right? And then the article goes on to say, Diane Oakley, who authored the report, stated, quote, the facts and data are clear. Retirement is in peril for most working class Americans. When all working individuals are considered, not just the minority with retirement accounts, the typical working American has zero, zilch, nothing saved for retirement. She continued, quote, what this report means is that the American dream of a modest retirement after a lifetime of work now is a middle class nightmare. Even among workers who have accumulated savings in retirement accounts, the typical worker had a low account balance of $40,000. This is far off track from the savings levels Americans need if they hope to sustain their standard of living in retirement. So of people that do have it, if you took the average of people that have money in their retirement account, they have an average of $40,000. What can you live off of? How long can you live off of $40,000? A year? 2 years? Probably 2 years max. I don't think most people could live on less than 20 a year, probably. So, yeah, Americans have...
They'd have to be completely debt-free in most of them.
Well, and then you'd have to be completely debt-free at that. Yeah, I mean, most people, come on, you're going to live off of $20,000 a year? I mean, most people couldn't pay their mortgage and their car payment with that, probably. So, yeah, it's really astounding. So as far as the retirement account goes, I mean, there's different thoughts on this. When you get a 401k or IRA or a Roth IRA, there is always a chance where an account like that could get nationalized by the government or something, and they've done it in other countries, and you can't take it out until you're 59 and a half, I think is the age. So there are advantages to doing it with a retirement account and advantages to not doing that. The advantage is it grows tax-free. With a 401k, an employer-sponsored 401k, or an IRA, it is tax-free when you put it in, so you're not taxed on that money that you put into it, and then it grows tax-free, and you get taxed on it at the end. With a Roth, you pay the taxes before you put it in, and it grows tax-free, and I think you only are taxed on the growth of it, as far as I know, whenever you end up taking it out. My concern with the Roth would be they can always change the rules, and they tax you when you put it in, then they'll tax you when you take it out, right? So you do have that to...
Kind of like
to
property taxes?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Then you could also just do a personal investment account. You could just open up a TD Ameritrade or Charles Schwab or whatever account like that. I know TD Ameritrade is one that I have, which it went from Scott Trade, which got bought out by... What was it? Scott Trade, and then it got bought out by another one, and then they got bought out by TD Ameritrade, so the account keeps changing hands. But anyway.
Do you like fees every month or year or something?
No, it's great. They don't charge you anything. And now they don't even charge you fees on trades. Mm-hmm. So you could sit there and day trade and sell, buy and sell stocks all day long. You don't pay anything. It used to be $7 a trade, buying and selling. Now you don't pay anything. So you can trade all day, trade all you want. You don't pay a thing. Which unless you know what you're doing, and next to nobody does, I do not recommend day trading. That's a sure way to lose a lot of money for, I'm sure, the vast majority of people, because that's a specialized deal, and I wouldn't try it either, because that's a really good way to lose money. But anyway, it's important to save for retirement in something, whether it's an IRA or 401k or just in a personal account, even a bank account. I just wouldn't leave it in a bank account. Because inflation will eat it away, even modest inflation at 2 or 3%, that you'll lose half your money probably about 30 years, even at 3%. Your money will be worth half what it is 30 years from now, just with a modest inflation like that. So it's good to invest in something that you can get growth in. With a 401k, the advantage to that is that a lot of time your employer will match the funds, and that's free money. So if they'll match 100% or 50%, then that's all free. And so some of them, like maybe they'll match 50% up to 6%, which means that if you put in 6%, then they're putting in 3%. So it's not a bad idea to at least put the minimum in to get the full company match. So if they match 100% up to 6%, put in 6% or whatever. And then it's like getting a 50% or 100% return on investment for doing absolutely nothing. So that can be a good thing to do. And then if you don't end up working at the same company for a while, you can get that employee match, stay long enough to get vested, which usually I think it's, I don't know, a few years. Once you get vested, then that you get to keep the money your employer put into it. Then when you go, you can take that money, you can put it in an IRA. You can transfer it over to an IRA, and then it's yours and you have total control over it. The problem with a 401k is usually they're traditional investments, just conventional investments, which has been fine for a long time up until now. But if you think the market's going to keep going ballistic like it is, then yeah, just jump in the S&P and enjoy the ride. If you don't think that's going to happen, and I don't, then I wouldn't want to be in the U.S. stock market in my retirement account, especially if I was getting close to retire. If you're a long ways away, it might not matter. But anyway, the nice thing about having like an IRA is that you can, like I'm with Euro Pacific Capital, and they're very non-traditional, and they're invested in foreign stocks, foreign dividend-paying stocks, and good foreign companies, which you also benefit from the falling dollar, because when the dollar's falling, you're earning in their currency, and their currency is stronger, so it's like it's a double earning, really, because you're getting paid out in dollars. And then they invest a lot in precious metals and mining stocks and things like that. So it's not conventional, but it's been doing well. Peter Schiff and his company has been doing well for the last 5 years. He did pretty pitifully for the five before that, but seems like now's a pretty good time for that investment strategy. So anyway, but it's just important to, probably the most important thing is just put money away every paycheck. Put it away, do as much as you can, and try to get it in something that will at least outpace inflation. But be careful, because things are risky. And if you invest in gold and silver mining stocks, companies, just beware that, some of them are up like 300% since March. But if you'd have bought them in August and sold them in November, you'd have lost 33%. But if you bought them in November and held until now, you'd have made 50%. So, they're volatile. But in the long run, I think they're going to do insanely well. But that's just my opinion. So, take it or leave it. But you look at the charts.
Gold's the same way. I went back and looked. And like from 2007 to now, 1 year, gold lost 38%. In like 2009 or 2010. So if you invested in 2007, but you had your sale at that year, you would have lost 38% of your investment.
Yeah, yeah. Just if you didn't.
Be real careful about that.
Yeah, if you'd have bought in 2011 and then sold in 2015, you'd have lost, a lot. You'd have lost almost half. But if you'd have bought in, say, 2015, now you would have made twice. You'd have doubled from 15 to now.
Like, for instance, say we invested then, and all of a sudden we really need the money, mm-hmm. and we had to sell the gold, we could have actually lost half our money because we need the money in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's possible.
So
yeah.
Big risk.
Yeah. Over time, gold is always going to perform like it does. When you look at it over the long term, gold basically just is a reverse of the value of the dollar. And as the dollar goes down, gold goes up. And as the dollar goes up, gold goes down, typically. So over the long term, it's not really not an investment. It'll just preserve your purchasing power. Gold mining stocks, like the companies themselves, that's more of an investment. But you got to have a stomach for that stuff because, You can make or lose as much in a day easily that it would take you a couple of years in a bank account to make. Easily. Now, if you get a stomach for it, doesn't bother me. Because
so is your best bet on that to invest in it and then just don't watch it all the time?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, because you want to look at like the big picture when it comes to that. And is the government going to keep spending money, right? Or the deficit's going to keep growing? If you think that's going to happen, then the value of the dollar keeps going down and the price of precious metals keeps going up. And when the price of precious metals go up, the companies that mine them can make a lot more money because they're selling the metals they're bringing out of the ground. So if you think that the government's going to keep growing, keep spending more, keep running deficits, then it's a good long-term investment. If you think all of a sudden they're going to get their house in order and they're going to cut the budget back and they're going to start running balanced budgets and all that, well, then, I mean, I'd be selling everything real fast because, yeah, that would not be a good investment anymore. So it depends on what your general worldview is, I guess, when it comes to that kind of thing.
And
how long?
You and I, we might invest some for 10 or 15 years. But Carissa and Christina, they can invest in some for 30.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big deal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that goes for any investment.
Yeah.
It's the same way with the stock market. Mm-hmm. If you'd have bought the stock market in 2008, you'd have lost 2/3 of your money. If you'd have sold it in, whatever, 2010, whenever it bottomed out.
So,
oh yeah, if you'd have bought it in the year 2000,
yeah,
and in the .com thing, you'd have lost a pile if you would have sold at the lows, right? So I mean, there's no investment that's going to be perfectly safe. And anybody, it always cracks me up when people say, "Oh, this is guaranteed 10% per year." Anybody that ever tells you anything is guaranteed, that they're lying to you, unless it's a guaranteed like 1% or something. But, yeah, I mean, you can guarantee that. But so anyway. But the important thing is just to start putting money away and do it as early as you can because you have time on your side, you know, whenever you do that. Yeah, I mean, if you're old, then it's another story. But when you're young,
that's where the statement,
it's a good idea.
If you're young.
Yes. So, as Proverbs 6:6 says, go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, because by doing so, first of all, we'll learn a good work ethic, because that little ant works like crazy. I mean, she works really hard. Secondly, we'll learn how to provide for ourselves. And then thirdly, we'll learn how to make hay while the sun shines and lay up wealth during our working years and that we'll be able to live on later on in life when we can't work anymore. So that takes care of Proverbs 6 and verse 8. All right, Proverbs 6 and verse 9. This will be the last one we'll cover tonight. So Solomon here is still talking about the sluggard, but he kind of switches gears and he goes into a different line of reasoning. Proverbs 6 and verse 9. It says, "How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep?" So he's continuing his condemnation of the lazy man, but with a different line of argumentation here in these next three verses. He goes on to say, "Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man." So he begins here with a rhetorical question, "How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard?" And I like these rhetorical questions in the Bible. You remember Pastor Mott did that study on the Socratic method back in Minneapolis a while back. But how many times God uses questions in the Bible? Right in the beginning, in the Garden of Eden. You know, who told thee thou wast naked? What hast thou done? Right? You know, different questions. And, you know, really penetrating questions that really get to the heart of something. So when Solomon says, "How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard?" he's not looking for an answer. Like the sluggard rolls up out of bed and says, "Oh, 12 hours? 14 hours?" Right? He's not actually looking for an answer. He's giving him a rebuke in the form of a question with hopes that it'll make the lazy bum think. And this is what we do when we ask our spouse or our children, "How long are you going to sleep?" Right? Are you going to sleep all day? Now, if a question won't get your kids out of bed, a rod across their butts will. So if you go to your teenagers and you say, "How long are you going to sleep?" and they just roll over, go get yourself a half-inch dowel rod, pull that cover back and give them a good one right across the butt, and I guarantee you they're going to be up in breakneck speed. That will take care of that lazy streak right away. There was a movie, I think it was called what was it called? I forget what it was called now. The Amazing Gift or something like that. And long story short, this guy had to, in order to get this giant inheritance, he had to go and learn how to work and be a man, basically. And he ended up going to stay with this rancher down in Texas. And the guy told him that breakfast is 5 o'clock and they'll be out working by 5:30 or something. And he didn't get up. And the guy comes in and takes a cattle prod and zaps him right in the butt. And the dude jumps out of bed and he's like, what are you doing? He's like, I told you breakfast is at 5 o'clock. And so anyway, that got him up right away. But both God and men in Scripture often ask sinners how long they will continue to sin. And I'm just going to run through a whole bunch of examples. And I have them printed out here, so you don't have to turn to them. I'm just going to read them off. And this is just going to prove the point by sheer volume here. Exodus 10:3. How long wilt thou refuse to humble thyself before me, the Lord says. Exodus 16:28. How long refuse ye to keep my commandments and my laws? Numbers 14:11. How long will this people provoke me? And how long will it be ere they believe me for all the signs which I have showed among them? Numbers 14:27. How long will I bear with this evil congregation which murmur against me? Joshua 18:3. How long are ye slack to go to possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers hath given you? 1 Samuel 16:1. How long wilt thou mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? 1 Kings 18:21. This is what Elijah said to the people of Israel whenever he was having that showdown on Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal. He said, how long halt ye between two opinions? Psalm 4:2. How long will ye turn my glory into shame? How long will ye love vanity and seek after leasing? That's lying. Psalm 82:2. How long will you judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? Proverbs 1:22. How long, ye simple ones, will you love simplicity, and the scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge? Jeremiah 4:14. How long shall thy vain thoughts lodge within thee? Jeremiah 23:26. How long shall this be in the heart of the prophets that prophesy lies? Jeremiah 31:22. How long wilt thou go about, O thou backsliding daughter? And then our Lord Jesus Christ's words in Matthew 17:17, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? So one thing you should learn from these verses is that God is long-suffering with sinners, including with lazy sinners, as he continually asks them. They get numerous exhortations of how long before God finally has enough. And he's like, you know what? You're getting the cattle prod. Because I've been asking, how long are you going to keep sleeping for long enough here? Solomon also uses the emphatic O to try to get through to the slow belly. Remember, he says, how long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? Remember, O, when it's standing before a noun in the vocative relationship, which is what this is, how long, O sluggard, how long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard, it means, when it's in other connections or without construction, expressing, according to intonation, various emotions as appeal, entreaty, surprise, pain, or lament. So in this case, it would be with emotions of appeal, entreaty, and lament. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? Entreating him, appealing to him, lamenting, like, get up. What are you doing? Why are you still sleeping? So one is justified using emotion while exhorting a lazy man to get out of bed. Now, Christians should not be lazy. Christians should have the best work ethic of anyone out there. And you know, if Christians in general, in the culture, had the best work ethic of anybody else, it would be so easy for us Christians to get jobs, to get high-paying jobs, and to be treated well. Because anybody would know, oh, you're a Christian? Oh, I'll hire you right now. Because I know you people work really hard. You're diligent. You're going to show up on time. You're going to work, you know, at 100% the whole time you're here. If Christians worked like that, we would have it really, really good.
Except it wouldn't last very long because people would catch on to that and everybody would be Christians.
That's true. But then they would have to somehow, yeah, they would have to determine, who the real Christians are, which is...
They'd show their colors once they were working.
They would.
If they got the job.
Then it would taint, oh, you're a Christian. You may or may not work hard.
Well, how about this? How about if Christians in a particular church, now our church is so small that nobody even knows who we are, but like, let's say you had a larger church and you had Christians in that church and this church was known, you hire a guy from this church and he is going to be the best, most diligent worker ever. People would be busting down the door to get in this church and I'd be shooing them off like a bunch of roaches, like, get out of here, and not letting them in if they were trying to get in here to make money, that is. But anyway, then it wouldn't be something where people would just say, oh, I'm a Christian. You'd have to say, are you a member of that church? If you're a member of that church, I'll hire you. If you're a member of the charismatic deal down the street, go somewhere else. Wouldn't that be something?
It's just like Amish. I mean, that's
right. It's, yeah, exactly.
You think about them, you think about good quality work.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, and hard work, good quality. Yep. You know, if you, at least where I'm from, if you hire an Amishman, chances are you're going to get good, hard work out of them. And they're known for that. Mennonites are the same way. And it should be that way with Christians. Christians are not to be slothful in business, but fervent in spirit. Romans 12 and verse 11. It says, not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Now, business is not confined to the sense that we think of it today. Did I give you the wrong reference? Okay. Oh, you might have got the wrong outline. I added this section in later.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Right, that's fine. Yeah, I added this in later. I got thinking about this would really fit in here.
Okay, I thought I got it right, but maybe I didn't.
That's okay. So business is not confined to the narrow sense that we use it today. Today, when you say business, you think about like a company, right? Somebody that owns some kind of a company or a shop or a restaurant or something. Business is the state of being busily engaged in anything. It's industry and diligence. And I remember I learned this from Pastor Mott. He said it numerous times in sermons. You want to distinguish the difference between business and busyness. Right? There's a big difference between business and busyness. Business is industry, diligence, working busily engaged in something that is profitable, right? Something that's worthwhile. Busyness, you can be busy watching YouTube. You can be busy, whatever, you know, going, you know, whatever, doing pleasurable things, right? You can be busy doing anything. But business is a different story. Business is whenever you are engaged in something that is profitable and useful. We're not supposed to be slothful in business. Now, slothful, when you're speaking of persons, means full of sloth, indisposed to exertion, inactive, indolent, lazy, or sluggish. And just, if you ever forget what slothful means, just think of the sloth, the animal, right? That all they do is just hang upside down all day long. They move at about a quarter of a mile an hour. What? They don't?
Nope. They're a lot more busy than we think they are.
Well, they certainly move slowly.
Yeah, they do move rather slowly, yeah. But they only sleep about 9 hours a day, and they patrol their territory all of the rest of the time, and they work very hard at it.
Really?
Yes.
They patrol.
Something that
really?
They eat just causes them to think and move slow like that, but they're not as...
They're not slothful.
Well, I've watched them at the zoo. I mean, those things move at a quarter mile an hour.
Yeah, they do move
no, really.
Slowly, but they are busy working.
They take like a week to even take a dump because they're, I'm serious, 2 weeks. Their internal organs are even slothful.
It takes that long.
Yeah, even their internal organs are slothful.
It's what they eat.
Yeah, I don't buy that.
Yes, it is.
Just because they move slow doesn't mean they're not being productive.
Well, they may be, but the point is they move very slowly. Would you hire one? I would not. Would you hire a sloth for a guard dog?
It depends on if the work was quality or not.
Would you hire a sloth for a guard dog?
No.
Well, I mean...
No, I would not hire a sloth for a guard dog. Everything would get by him. He moves at a quarter mile an hour, I'm telling you. They are vicious, though. They can... They do have some claws and.
Remember that movie wherein they were likened to DMV?
But they're not vicious
right.
either. They're very cuddly and sweet.
Well, only if you get on their bad side, they're not. They were on this show, the 70 most dangerous animals in Asia or something, and. I didn't know Bev had such an affinity for sloths.
They're cute though. They are.
They're very gentle.
I don't know how they could help but be. They can't move fast enough to hurt you.
Oh, they have really sharp claws, though.
It's like in that animated movie, yes. Whenever they go to the DMV and the sloths are running the DMV.
Yes.
If you haven't seen that, it's hilarious. Oh, it's really funny. All right, anyway, after that slothful debate, I'm going to get back to this. We're not supposed to be slothful in business, but fervent in spirit. Fervent is hot, burning, glowing, boiling. Of persons, their passions, dispositions, or actions, ardent, intensely earnest. So when we work, we should be as if we're on fire. Like if you were on fire, like if you were literally on fire, you'd be moving pretty quickly to get yourself off fire, right? And so we should be like that when we're working hard and not moving slowly, because you know the slower you move, the less you get done. Unless you can move too fast, right? You can do sloppy work that way. But when you can move quickly, you should be moving quickly. Now, this, of course, would be age-dependent as well. When you get to be, and no joking aside, when you get to be in your 70s and 80s, you just can't work as fast as you did when you were in your 20s or 30s, obviously. So you just have to adjust your expectations as you get older and just realize that you just can't, you're not going to be able to do the amount of things and as fast as you used to be. And that, there's nothing wrong with that. That's life. But whatever work we have to do should be done busily, with diligence, not lazily and sluggishly. Did you ever notice that work will pretty much take, and I'd say with rare exception, work will take the allotted time to get done. If you have 8 hours to get the ditch dug, you will be scooping out the last piece of dirt at 7 hours and 59 minutes. And if you had an hour to get the same ditch dug, you would be scooping it out at 59 minutes. Most people, you ever notice this? They will take the full amount of time that they have. If you know, kids in school, if the paper's due in 2 weeks from now, they start working on it on, you know, the Thursday before it's due on Friday, right? That's what most people do. Not everybody, but a lot of people are like that. They take the whole amount of time.
But I do my best work when it's on
time. Well, and some people are like that. That is true. And I don't. And I know I have a pastor friend, which none of you know him, but we are completely opposite because he, like for him, whatever he's thinking about this week is what he's going to preach on Sunday. And there's nothing wrong with this. We're just different. And so he doesn't think beyond Sunday. That's it. And for me, it's like if I don't have, I don't know, 2 or 3 months worth of sermons in my file already ready to go, I'm like, man, I got to get working here. I'm getting nervous. Right, I don't have it. You know, I don't know what am I going to preach on in 3 months from now or whatever. And so I'm just totally different.
Never mind the stuff that's supposed to take 2 weeks takes 2 months. Then
well,
you've got
yeah,
a year's worth.
And that happens too. Yes.
Good point.
And that might be why I end up with 2 or 3 months in the queue because things take longer than I thought they would. But, so I'm different that way. But yeah, everybody. Some people do well under pressure. I don't. I can't write a
paper when I have a week to go because my thoughts and things just don't come together. But if it's due on that day when I'm working on it, all the thoughts come together and I get an A on the paper.
Yeah. Well.
All well and good as long as nothing jettisons your plans that day.
Right. Exactly.
Vomiting or somebody's.
Or, yes, that's right.
It's true.
I have really cheerful thoughts.
So Christians should do their work or whatever they do with all of their might. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10. It says, "Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave, whither thou goest." Now remember, Ecclesiastes is written to men under the sun. You'll notice you'll get that phrase in Ecclesiastes a lot, under the sun. There's nothing new, no new thing under the sun. And there's a couple of places here I could probably find you one if I looked here carefully. Oh, with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun. Yes. And there's another one, too. Where is it? I probably won't be able to find it now. But anyway, you'll notice that phrase. in Ecclesiastes a lot, under the sun. And that will explain this verse and many other verses in Ecclesiastes, because there are verses in Ecclesiastes like this one here in verse 5. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 5, "For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten." And you're like, well, the dead not know anything? People that are dead, they're in heaven. You're saying they don't know anything? Solomon is looking at under the sun. Oh, here we go, verse 3. "This is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart where they live, and after that they go to the dead." So, under the sun, earth, from an earthly perspective alone, from a bodily perspective, when you die, that's it. You die, your body goes to the grave. And you don't think about anything, you don't have any memory, that's it. Your life is over, from an earthly, bodily perspective. "And whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest." So under the sun, once you die, you're not going to get any more work done. You're not going to be able to accomplish anything more. So work hard, do it with all thy might, because whenever you die, that's it under the sun. Of course, we have the afterlife. We have the new earth when we get new bodies, and we can continue doing work. But from an earthly perspective, that's it. So work as hard as you can while you can. Christians should work heartily as if they were working for the Lord and not men. Colossians 3 and verse 23. Colossians 3, 23. This is a verse that every one of us, if we don't have it memorized, we should at least know the concept of it well and remind ourselves of this, because we'll be a lot better employees, or a lot better anything. Whatever we do will be a lot better if we remembered this. Colossians 3:23, "And whatsoever ye do it heartily, as to the Lord, and not unto men, knowing that of the Lord ye shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for ye serve the Lord Christ." Sometimes, the work that we do on this earth, we think, what's the point? It just seems like it's drudgery. What is the point? The point is you're working for the Lord no matter what you do. Whatever your job is, it has value and it has meaning because you're doing it for the Lord, and you will receive a reward from the Lord because you're serving the Lord Christ. Whatsoever you do, do it heartily. Heartily is with full or unrestrained exercise of real feeling, with genuine sincerity, earnestly, sincerely, really, with goodwill, cordially. It's also with courage, zeal, or spirit, spirited, zealously. So there's two different aspects to heartily. There is the sincerity aspect, and then there's the zealous aspect. And if you put those two things together, and if you work zealously and sincerely for the Lord in whatever you do, you're going to be a really good employee, or you're going to be a really good self-employed person. You're going to be a really good student or son or daughter or father or mother or wife or husband or whatever. You're going to be a pastor. You're going to be a really good whatever you do if you do it as if you're doing it to the Lord. So just remember that when you're doing your work, no matter what it is, just imagine if Jesus was standing behind you, watching you and telling you, hey, go over there and dig that ditch. Go over there and break up that concrete, you know, and pour some new ones or whatever, you know. Study that Bible, get that outline put together. Whatever your job is, cook dinner, right? Clean the house, do the laundry, whatever your job is. Just imagine Jesus is there telling you to do it and watching. And we would all be a lot better workers. So Christians should work zealously and sincerely as if they were doing it directly for God. And those who do so those who work diligently will go places in life. Proverbs 22 and verse 29. Proverbs 22:29. "Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men." Mean meaning base or average. Just, you know, just your nobody that's of any importance or significance. You're not going to stand before men like that if you're diligent in your business. You're going to stand before kings. Think about Joseph. Joseph, classic example. Diligent in his business. He went to Potiphar's house as a servant, and he was so diligent, Potiphar put him in charge of everything. Potiphar didn't even know what was going on in his house because Joseph took care of everything. And then Joseph got put in prison, and guess what? Joseph was diligent in the prison, and he was running the prison. And then he gets out of the prison, and he goes to the Pharaoh's house, and then he runs the entire nation, a world empire. Joseph ran. Why? Because he was diligent in his business, and he stood before kings, not before mean men. Diligent, when we're speaking of persons, means constant in application, persevering in endeavor, assiduous, industrious, not idle, not negligent, not lazy. So somebody that's diligent is the opposite of lazy. They're hardworking. They're not standing around. When you have a diligent employee, if he doesn't have anything to do, he's not just going to sit there on his phone and goof around. He's going to come and say, hey, what do you need me to do? What can I do next? Right? That's a diligent employee. The lazy employee is going to sneak off and go to the Port-a-John or something or somewhere where he can goof off and hopefully he doesn't get caught or found out, right? That's the difference. So he says, how long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? So a sluggard, and I know I've defined this before, I'm pretty sure, but just to refresh your memory, a sluggard is one who is naturally or habitually slow, lazy, or idle. One who is disinclined for work or exertion of any kind, a slothful or indolent person. When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? So we see here sluggards are lazy and they love to sleep. And the thing is about being lazy, if you're lazy, it will make you tired and it'll make you want to sleep. You ever experienced that? Right? You're just kind of sitting around, you're just not doing anything, you're just not in a good mood, you just don't feel like doing anything. And before you know it, you get really tired, and you're just yawning. You're like, oh, I'm just really tired. I don't know. I don't know why I'm tired. I didn't do anything all day. That's why you're tired. You didn't do anything all day. That's why you're tired. Proverbs 19 and verse 15. And we all know. I mean, we've all been there. Every single one of us knows what that feels like. It says, slothfulness casteth into a deep sleep, and an idle soul shall suffer hunger. I know for me, sitting around for hours makes me tired. I pretty much can't take a full day off. I can take part of a day off, but if I take a whole day off and just did nothing, I'd just be going crazy. I just can't. I just feel like I gotta go do something. I gotta run back to my office and work on something or do something. I just don't like just sitting around all day long. A sluggard, because he is lazy, he'll just keep turning over in his bed instead of getting up. Proverbs 26 and verse 14. It says, as the door turneth upon his hinges, so doth the slothful upon his bed. You know, the door turning upon its hinges is ring, 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 ring. Just door open and close and open and close, and there's a slothful rolling from one side to the other, on his left shoulder, on his right shoulder, on his stomach, on his back. Just keeps rolling around, doesn't want to get up. The longer he sleeps, the more tired he will be when he finally gets up, and the more worthless he'll feel. You ever do that? You ever sleep way too long? You just didn't feel like getting up? You sleep too long, you get up, and you're just tired. Like, why am I tired? I just slept for 10 hours. That's because you slept for 10 hours. That's why. You slept too long. This, in turn, will make him sit around and be lazy, which will make him more tired and wanting to go to sleep again. And it is a vicious cycle. And this is something, a cycle that needs to be broken. And people that are depressed end up getting in this cycle, right? They're depressed, and they lay in bed, and they don't want to get up. And they roll from one side to the other, and they keep hitting the snooze button, and then finally just turn the alarm off, and they just keep sleeping. And they finally decide to get up, and then they're groggy, and they're tired, and then they sit around, and then they feel bad because they know they just slept way too long, and I feel too tired to do anything. And now I'm just like, you know, I'm just so tired, I want to go back to bed. And then it just repeats the old process over and over again. Now, sleep is a good thing. There's nothing like lying down to sleep after a good hard day's work. You do especially good either manual labor or really a good day's work of mental labor, either one. When you do a good hard day's work and you are tired, there's nothing like laying your head down and sleeping whenever you've done that. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 12 says, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. So you labor, you lay your head down, and you are out like a light. That feels wonderful. Whether you eat little or much, even if you're not making a fortune, you work hard, you feel good at night. You lay down and you sleep. Now, the rich guy, though, he can't sleep because he's got too much stuff to worry about. he's worrying about this investment and this property and that property and this company and that. He can't sleep. So, you know, sometimes it's just better to have the middle station of life and not have too much wealth and too much responsibility so that you lose your peace. I would say, and I have no evidence for this whatsoever, I'm just guessing, that there is a lot of sleeping disorders in this country. You know, I don't know if you know that, but there's a lot of people that have sleeping disorders. And I will bet that a lot of it is due to a lot of people aren't working today, right? A lot of people are laid off, or a lot of people are on disability or whatever. And I'll bet you that has a lot to do with the sleeping disorders, because they're not doing a full day's labor and really working hard, and then, you know, it's hard to sleep whenever you didn't really do anything. So it wouldn't surprise me. Like I said, I'm just speculating. I don't know that.
Working from home during the pandemic.
Right. Yep.
A friend of mine's wife has been offered the opportunity to stay working from home for her company. It's a huge company down in the city that she works for, and they put pretty much everybody, hundreds of employees, home during the pandemic. Her boss called her and said that her and two others were the only three out of the whole company whose workload went up when they were working from home.
Is that right?
She's a hard worker, but out of hundreds of employees, three, their production went up. And so she and those other two, I guess, were being presented the opportunity to continue to work from home if they would like to, but everybody else was getting called back.
That's interesting, because I've heard other companies that have found that actually their production went up whenever they had people working from home.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm sure it would depend.
Yeah. But Mona says that. She said, you don't have people stopping by your desk, interrupting you. You're on this task, and they can't, well, what should I do about this?
Yep.
Or chattering. Bruce says that, too. So I don't quite, mm-hmm. I thought it would be more like that, where people just aren't going to be that diligent. For one thing, I think the mindset, you go to work, you're not hanging out in your sweats, because they really only see you from here up. You're not just being slouchy. You have to look like something to go to work.
You have to present yourself.
But they, my guess
would be good employees are more productive at home and bad employees are less productive at home. I would guess that.
Nobody watching over you.
And people that are self-motivated and they'll work hard regardless, they'll do better at home because there are less distractions. And that would be my guess. And maybe there are some companies that are just, they or some teams and companies that just have a bunch of really good, diligent, hardworking guys, and at home they do great, and maybe the other places have a different atmosphere or different people. And that's the only way I can make sense of it anyway. But.
And there's some people just need someone watching them all the time but don't do squat.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So I can go out, like I had this guy I got rid of at work. And I took, when I left, I knew before he was out of his job. I knew where he should be at when I got back from 2 days of vacation. It looked like he worked about 3 hours.
Yeah. Yep.
So when you're here, and I had a talk.
Yeah. Yep. There's always going to be people like that. So sleep is necessary for the body to rejuvenate and heal itself. So it is a good thing. I mean, when Solomon's condemning the sluggard for sleeping, it's not because he's sleeping. It's because he's sleeping too much. John 11 and verse 12, the disciples said whenever Jesus told them that Lazarus was sleeping, they thought he was naturally sleeping. Jesus was speaking about death. But it says there in verse 12, John 11, 12, then said his disciples, Lord, if he sleep, he shall do well. So they recognized that sleep was helpful to the body. And I think that's probably the best thing you can do. If you get sick, just sleep. Get plenty of sleep. And if you want to prevent yourself from getting sick, in my experience, get enough sleep. I can almost guarantee you every time I get sick, it's because I was not getting enough sleep. I've been up late several nights in a row or something and I was weak. When I get good sleep, I normally don't get sick. So yeah, sleep's very important. And it's foolish to deprive oneself of necessary sleep. Psalm 127 and verse 2. This is not wise. There are a lot of people that do this. A lot of people in this country. Like I said, we have a major split. We have a bunch of lazy people in this country, but then we got a bunch of people that work way too much and overwork themselves and don't get enough sleep. And both positions are equally wrong. Psalm 127 in verse 2. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. So it is vain, worthless endeavor to get up early and sit up late. It's fine to get up early if you don't sit up late. And I guess it's okay to sit up late as long as you don't get up early if you're getting enough sleep. But to burn it on both ends of the candle, to stay up late and get up early, is very foolish. God gives sleep as a blessing to his children, to his beloved. I'm a big firm believer in sleep, and I'm a firm believer in, and I'm going to talk about that. I need 7.5, and everybody's different. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. But I'm a firm believer in sleep, and I'm a firm believer in scheduled sleep, especially for children. It is crucial for children, the younger they are, but children in scheduled sleep, get to sleep the same time every night, get up at the same time every morning. They've written whole books about this. Very, very important. And for me, if I get to bed at the same time and get up at the same time every day, I do a lot better. And I would think that most people do. So diligent men sleep to live. Sluggards live to sleep. Right? A lot of truth to that, I think. Now, everyone needs a different amount of sleep. Most people need between 6 and 9 hours of sleep per night to be healthy and feel well-rested. That most people fall in there. There is the occasional weirdo that only needs 4 hours of sleep, and I envy him forever, because if I only needed 4 hours of sleep, I couldn't tell you the amount of stuff I could get done. I'd have an extra 3.5 hours every single day. I could get all kinds of stuff done, and that would be awesome. But anyway, but most people need 6 to 9 hours. I need 7.5, and I've just figured this out with trial and error, basically, over the years. If I get less than 7.5, I feel tired. And I can pretty well tell. I get up, and I just have that tired feeling. Not the sleepy feeling. Like, I feel tired every morning when I get up, but I have that worn-out feeling. You know, when you get up, you got that feeling? I got to have 7.5 hours. 7 to 7.5, anyway. So here's the thing. Don't condemn a person who needs 8 hours of sleep per night if you only need 6. Because people's bodies are different. So if you need 6 and some guy gets 8 and you're like, you are so lazy, sleeping 8 hours, I can't believe it, I slept 8 hours, I wouldn't know what to do with myself. Don't do that, because, or even 9 hours, because there are people that actually need that amount of sleep. I should have looked it up before I got here, but I think I remember reading that Einstein needed a ton of sleep, like 9 hours or something like that. I could be remembering that wrong. But I've heard of very productive, highly intelligent people that need a ton of sleep. And so, we usually think about productive people that they never sleep. Not smart, productive people. They get enough. Now, there's a big difference between the person who only needs 7 hours of sleep, but is too lazy to get up and sleeps for 8 or 9, and the person who needs 8 or 9 hours to feel well-rested and not be tired and dragging all day. So there's a big difference, right? There's a big difference between the guy that needs 7 and sleeps for 8 or 9, right? Just because he's lazy and he just doesn't want to get up. And the guy that needs 8 or 9, right? Big difference between the two. Now, I'm just going to leave you with this. This is interesting. Imagine how much more a lazy person could get done in a lifetime if he didn't sleep an extra hour every day and instead use that hour productively. I'm talking about an extra hour that you don't need, right? So for me, 7.5, if I slept 8.5 hours every night just because I'm lazy and the alarm goes off and I just don't feel like getting up and I hit the snooze, and then turn it off, and I get up 8.5 hours every day. I'll show you how much production I would lose. If a man did so, if he slept that extra hour, between the ages of 15 and 75, so pretty much your working years, I mean, you could, 75, you're getting pretty old, but anyway, when you could be doing something productive, right, from 15 to 75, roughly, most people lived about 75. If you did that for those years, you would have 21,900 extra hours of productive time during your life. That's an extra 2,737 hours and a half of 8-hour workdays. So an extra 2,700 workdays you could have by not sleeping that extra hour that you don't need. That's an extra 10.5 years of extra 8-hour workdays. So is it any wonder that although we all have the same amount of hours in a day, some people accomplish far more in their lives than others? You sleep one extra hour and you have 10.5 years less of productive work that you could do versus the person that didn't. Think about that. Now, that's not even to mention the time that we all spend goofing off and messing around when we could have been doing something productive during our waking hours. Imagine how many decades more productive work you could get done and more accomplished if you didn't sleep too much and if you didn't goof around and waste your time. Decades. And you wonder, you look at people, how do they get this all done? How did that guy write 2 dozen books in his lifetime? You know how hard it is to write a book? I mean, a real book? Like, I don't even write real books. These commentaries on Proverbs, that's not a real book. I mean, that's just writing my thoughts on each verse, right? I mean, it takes time and it's hard, but that's not a real book. I'm talking about a real book where you have to research a topic and know a ton of stuff about a topic, and you've got, 200 citations in the back of the book from hundreds of other books that you've read and learned enough to be able to present this topic. You know how much time that takes? That's an incredible amount of time. And there are people that crank out tons of books in a lifetime. You know how they do it? It's not by sleeping all day. It's not by goofing around and wasting their time. It's about working hard and making the most of the time that they have. So think about that. Every time you use that extra hour of sleep, 10 and a half years, you could have accomplished more stuff by the end of your life. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? Get up and get something done. That's what I got to say.